from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Today on the show, we're going to talk about the history of humanism, because I feel like, at least in the past few weeks, humanism has been, I don't want to say under attack, because that wouldn't be the fair way to put it, but I think that a lot of people have kind of dismissed humanism as some sort of placating philosophy and so on and so forth. And this is in the light of a new proposal, say, of a movement by Jen McCrite, the Blag Hag, who said that we should now be atheist plus. So essentially take anything from humanism and associated with atheism, but with a much stronger emphasis on the fact that we don't believe in fucking God. So we're going to be talking about that today. And I wanted to actually mention the history of humanism because, you know, since it is born out of medieval Europe, yes, it has religious undertones to it, as we'll see throughout the show. But I think it's still important to recognize humanism as a sort of slow development of a general philosophy of human life. And that's what we're going to be talking about. But first, I want to mention something that Ryan has decided to purchase.
Well, it wasn't really a decision. That's the whole thing. It was more of an accident. You guys remember in the last show? That made it up, right? That wasn't part of the lost show conversation?
No, I'm pretty sure you made it up.
Okay, yeah. I was talking about how I wanted to get into the future where basically everybody is suspended from hooks from the ceiling wearing VR helmets and completely immersed in a virtual world. We'll get there, and when we do, we'll look back on, you know, us sitting here staring at these fucking tubes, the radiating light, and think, why were we doing it like that? But, you know, I was pretty excited about it. I got a couple drinks into me, and I went on eBay, and I found this Sony virtual reality like monitor / head camera / VR thing.
It pretty much looks like the same thing from Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description. It's very cyberpunk. That's one of the pluses of it. So I bid on it because it was at a reasonable price, and thinking, like, you know, like everything else on eBay that you ever try and buy, in the last like 2 or 3 hours, somebody will outbid you by 10 cents and just win that item.
So, but you had to guard this bitch like a champion.
Well, this is the whole thing. That's what I was expecting. I was like, I'll throw up an offer, and there's going to be more. There's 5 days left on this eBay thing, so what's the chances of me getting it? Well, 5 days later, and I'm 2 hours away from winning it. So I might be going off into VR land very soon.
Yeah, I think I know why, though.
What do you mean you know why?
Yeah, no one wants it.
Yeah, probably. Probably, which is stupid, though. I think it's going to be awesome. I'm still kind of excited about it. It is a bit silly.
A little bit silly. You're Johnny fucking Mnemonic. That's a silly movie. Next thing you know, I'm going to be storing data in your head at the tune of like 20 gigabytes.
Well, you just wait and see who's the cool guy when I've got that motherfucker hooked onto my head and I'm flying through the internet.
I don't really need to. Yeah, it doesn't. The internet doesn't fly at you. That's the first problem on the internet. I could understand the fucking visors if it was like Johnny Mnemonic, where he's like traveling all crazy, like in this virtual space. I mean, do you remember the OS in Hackers? You could justify your stupid helmet if the interface was like that of Hackers, where you're just somehow like navigating through this, you know, cyberspace thing where it looks like little highways, but of course electronic highways and all this other kind of ridiculous nonsense. This is otherwise what you're looking at is still the same old web page, except for now you have glasses in your fucking face. Tell me, what is the difference here? What are you experiencing more that the average person with a really giant monitor is not experiencing?
Well, it would have to be a really giant monitor. It would have to be something like, I don't know, like 6 feet across. It's very impressive how they fill up your entire field of vision with awesomeness.
You haven't really tried this thing, so you don't know. I mean, it could just be headache-inducing within the first 5 minutes of you wearing this motherfucker.
Yeah, it definitely could be. There's definitely the chance for neck problems and eye problems and the technology not being there. Sony hasn't managed to put out a new device in a very long time that's impressed me. So I'm kind of going out on a limb here. It was, as I said, I was slightly drunk when I made the decision to bid on it.
Impulse purchase of the
But
future.
I regret nothing. Wait, when I have it, you guys will hear about how cool it is. And then you can join me in cyberspace as the first, first people to fully immerse themselves in it.
Yeah, I strongly recommend you not do that. Look, I've adopted early technologies in the past, and almost every single fucking time I've regretted it. Not because the technology wasn't cool, but because it didn't do some of the things that I needed it to do properly. Remember when I bought that Sony fucking e-reader and that piece of shit couldn't even read PDFs? Like, what are you supposed to do with a device that can't read PDF or shit?
Plus, nothing was even coming out as an e-book. Remember those days back where just couldn't buy e-books? It's nice that that's over now, but...
Well, that was the problem with the early adoption, really. And I think that early adoption of any technology offers that same problem where, okay, the features might be cool, but now nothing works because it requires this other support network of individuals that don't yet exist. Like with your virtual helmets, you would kind of need to change the browsing experience to making it a little bit more visceral, because right now it's flat and two-dimensional. It might as well just be a fucking scroll. You know, we still use that word when describing internet browsing, scrolling. So we haven't really fucking gone further than, we haven't really just gone off the deep end when it comes to the way that we absorb content. Not like hackers or Johnny Mnemonic. We're still at the, hey, read something on a flat 2D plane.
Yeah, it's not Iron Man yet, but it's never going to get there unless somebody takes the leap, and I'm willing to be the guinea pig here. My goal is I would like to be able to, those seats that kind of like lean back, and I would like to be able to get myself into a position where I was sitting in a way that wasn't potentially murdering me slowly.
You should be lying down, actually. It's a lot healthier for you.
Yeah, exactly. So if I can get to some kind of point where I just become like a Howard Hughes type character, lying down and interacting with the cyber world for, I don't know, 60% of the day, I'd be okay with that.
What an interesting person to select from. You mean the guy who was storing urine in jars and wore like tissue boxes on his feet and didn't cut his nails? This is the man you want to emulate.
I'm just saying I've accepted the fact that I'm strange, and I'm just going to roll with it now. Maybe I'll wear the VR suit while I'm wearing my Pikachu costume and really go the whole nine yards.
I think that you've separated yourself from reality, and I welcome / pity anyone who joins you in this world, in this new world. Okay, let's move on to the main crux of the show. So this is going to be a little bit long because I'm going to try to cover the early Renaissance period, which is when humanism becomes a thing. So, I mean, I understand it's a bit ambitious to talk about humanism because it goes all the way back to the 13th century. And if anyone's ever studied history, you realize that the study of history is really just it's not an exact science. It's obviously going to be based much more on consensus, which, you know, like every time people say science is not about consensus, well, fucking history is apparently about consensus. And if that makes you uncomfortable, well, don't be a historian.
What I've always found interesting about history, like take a look at another podcast that I really like, Hardcore History. The thing about that is, especially when you're listening to stuff like the Roman histories or the Roman Empire, very often the host will make it clear that, he's giving you history, but he's giving you the history as it was reported by these people. So you're really just getting the version that was made official. And as far as how close it was to the actual truth, you can't put too much stock into it, you know what I mean? Because obviously the stories have been fluffed up a little bit.
Well, it's not just that they've been fluffed up, is that a lot of times, I mean, I think Richard Carrier actually wrote a book about how do you really determine the truthfulness of historical accounts? Because obviously there's a few problems. Like, let's say we're trying to analyze the actual history of Caligula, right? Well, we have a few problems. And the first problem is that when Caligula was in power to pay off the national debt, he basically took all the Roman senators' wives and sold them over to prostitution. Now, let me ask you this question. Would that generate enough bad blood that perhaps the history books wouldn't be altogether honest about your rule? Just as a kind of afterthought?
Sounds like the kind of thing they'd say about Barack Obama. 100 years from now.
Well, I mean,
maybe even that initial accusation is just the result of bad will from, I don't know, some other stuff that he did, like try to give people health care or something.
The monster. But yeah, like obviously when you're dealing with history, you're dealing with a lot of different sources, often like speaking hundreds of years after the fact, you know, and who knows where they get most of their data. So it is a bit of a complicated thing. But I can tell you actually that the early period that we essentially attribute to the Renaissance, the reason I can actually confidently tell you I'm like that this is probably the way that history played out is that in terms of history, this is pretty contemporary. Like, we have a lot of information about the individuals that lived during that time because records are pretty good. And, you know, because there's so many different records coming from so many different places, we're able to extrapolate more truth at them. It's a bit harder when you start dealing with, you know, ancient Roman history. But as you move closer to, you know, the modern age, just fucking data gets better. You know, you have more of it to fucking garner. Now, here's the first thing. When talking about the history of humanism, by the way, the first thing I want people to understand is that the concept that you have in your brain about what humanism means is not really where the word comes from. Okay? So when we think humanism, we're like, well, human-centered, right? Like human-centric. But really, the word actually comes from the Greek humanisti, which basically means the study of humanities, right? So we're talking like social sciences, like the soft sciences, civics, and all those other kinds of things. So we begin, like the name actually comes from a 19th century German scholar who tried to describe the events that were happening in 13th and 14th century Europe. Because, you know, even back then, they were just trying to make sense of what the fuck was going on. So this is where humanism really, like the word begins from this humanisti. This study of social science. And it really was at the time, at least during the 13th century, a reawakening to the ancient Latin texts that the church had basically said, you know, this is heretical writings, don't really read this, all you need to do is follow church doctrine and you're going to be fucking fine. But it turns out that, you know, like any human being, people are fucking curious and they want to know more. And during the 13th century, there were starting to be people who, you know, because the Catholic Church was using Latin, there was a lot of fucking texts from the Roman world that were also in Latin. And so there was this guy called by the name of Francesco Petrarch, or everybody also just knows him as Petrarch, who's pretty much the father of humanism. And this guy's a pretty interesting dude. He is apparently the world's first tourist, like the first man in the history of the fucking world, apparently, to travel just for pleasure and not for money.
It's an interesting distinction.
It is a bit of an interesting distinction. I think tourism only dates back to the 13th century, apparently. Everybody else, if you traveled, it's because you needed to fucking make money or get the fuck out of town or whatever. But he is the first man who's like, I'm going to travel around for pleasure. And during one of these trips, he decides that he's going to climb a mountain in France, a fairly high mountain that apparently most people would be like, no one's ever climbed this mountain. It's way too fucking high. So he decides he's going to fucking climb it anyways. Because, like I said, he's a tourist. So on Mount Ventoux, which is in France, he climbs up. And at the end of it, you know, imagine he's sort of climbs this mountain. There's a beautiful scenery all around him. And he's probably never seen this. Right, he, you know, being used to the ground level, but right at the moment where most people would sort of have a profound realization about the outside world and that kind of stuff, this guy actually has an internal revelation, because he brings with him a book from Sir Thomas Aquinas, and he reads this one quote that apparently changes his life and, well, apparently all of our lives, and the quote goes as this: "And men go about to wonder at the heights of the mountains, and the mighty waves of the sea, and the wide sweeps of the rivers, and the circuits of the ocean, and the revolutions of the stars, but themselves they consider not." So when he read that, he kind of viewed it as this whole idea that we're often a little bit too impressed by the outside world, and we seem to underestimate the importance of the internal world, the world of, at least how 13th century fucking Italians would have viewed it, the world of the soul, right? Your own personal conscience and your interaction with the world. And I think when he read that, in a sense, I guess he felt fired towards this idea that maybe it was more important to look internally rather than to try to look at the outside world, like to fix what the fuck was wrong with us inside. And I think what was interesting about, you know, sort of like this attitude is that, you know, one of the ways that he thought that you could actually solve this issue was by reading classical literature, like going back to the fucking ancients, right? Going back to the Romans and the Greeks that had already just developed an entire branch of philosophy that had been ignored during most of the medieval ages. And in fact, when he starts reading some of these discourses and he personally finds a number of letters by a Roman senator by the name of Cicero, and we're going to talk more about him, but after he discovers Cicero's writings, he suddenly, you know, it's like an epiphany for him where he finds that all of this knowledge from the past is actually much more contemporary than modern medieval times, and he's the guy that actually comes up with the moniker of the Dark Ages. So I think the reason why we attribute the Renaissance to this man, first of all, is because, as ironic as it sounds, is that he was the first to really look back. Well, the church had been busy saying, like, hey, everything is all good. We don't need any new ideas or philosophy. We've fucking done it.
Everything's being invented, man. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. And plus, I mean, remember, at the time, I mean, like, the church was a fairly universal force, right? The Catholic Church didn't have any reform movements by then. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of really serious thinkers. Most people were obsessed with the idea of perfection. This is where most philosophers kind of like dug themselves into. And that usually incorporated something along the lines of working with gold. Because the ancient, you know, like the medieval mind thought that gold was like the most perfect substance in the fucking universe. Because it could, you know, it could be infinitely malleable. It could take on any shape and then be reshaped. So they thought that gold was perfection. And, you know, anytime you read about, like, you know, cities or streets of gold, when, you know, describing heaven, it's not just because it's a precious metal, it's because of its properties. Like, people thought this is the most perfect fucking metal in the universe, despite its incredible weight. So we have, okay, so like I said, we have the beginnings of the humanist movement starts with Petrarch, who discovers a number of Latin-based texts, mostly from Cicero. And now, if you don't know who Cicero is, I think I should probably sort of like cover a little bit about this guy. You ever watch the Rome, you know, like that series on HBO?
Yeah, the one that they unfortunately canceled because it was so expensive.
Really?
You'd think like a bunch of togas and, you know, a place with a lot of columns wouldn't be difficult to come by, but you'd be wrong.
Well, the problem is every show is like an hour. It's a lot to produce, dude.
Yeah, no 20 minutes of Geico commercials.
Yeah, but don't you feel like, I mean, by the end of the second season, you weren't satisfied? I don't know if I needed a third.
Yeah, it's probably one of those shows that got what it needed to get.
Right. Well, if you're watching Rome, it's interesting because Cicero lives during that time. He's a senator right before Julius Caesar becomes, you know, like the dictator, and then who's later killed. And he's actually one of the ones who actually becomes murdered because he doesn't really, you know, fit into the new world. But Cicero was apparently the most unbelievable speaker of his time. And I think this is important because back in the days before they had, like, you know, multimedia and news corporations and things like that, your reputation was entirely based on how well you communicated with everybody else. And Cicero was like the fucking man. And here's the crazy thing that actually happened. I was trying to research about, like, you know, Cicero, as I said, and the beginning of the Renaissance, and I didn't really quite realize that Cicero is probably the most important intellectual ever. Ever. I mean, every major philosopher during the Renaissance and even during the Enlightenment had all read this guy. Thomas Jefferson was the biggest fucking Cicero fan. And the Declaration of Independence, by the way, is largely attributed to his writings. How fucked up is that? Like, this man like I said, is probably the most important thinker, and for the most part, most of us are completely ignorant of it. Ignorant of him. Who's Cicero? What did he? What was he talking about? Well, for the most part nowadays, we don't give a shit. But back in the day, he was the man. You know, like, I can't even stress, like, what is the equivalent of him philosopher intellectual-wise? Maybe our version of the Einstein. You know, you know what I mean?
He's the philosopher Justin Bieber.
No, never say that together in a series of words. It doesn't even make sense. I think here's one of the things that really created the Renaissance movement and the early humanist movement, and this is an important element, is the rise of individualism. Because in the medieval mind, it was like, you're just a fucking puppet of the state. You live in a feudal system that's essentially being dictated by, you know, the Pope and his fucking merry band of men. And there's really no place for you. Like, you're a cog in the wheel. But as we notice, like, during the Renaissance, one of the first people to actually write about the rise of individualism, ironically enough, is Machiavelli. Like, we have really good memories of what he wrote, right? The Prince is not exactly a document of kindness and moral behavior, but it is a treatise of individualism. It's like, here's one person pursuing his interest to its, I don't want to say disastrous conclusions, but you know what I mean. Like, if you're familiar with The Prince, you realize that this is not a moral treatise of how to act, but really just more of an analysis of how one person can selfishly essentially take over. And while we might just be able to, you know, while we might say The Prince is a fucking immoral piece of work, I think we have to remember that at the time, remember, individualism was not a thing. You were just a fucking puppet of the state. So it's interesting that humanism, the study of human concerns, is really the rise of the individual and his contribution. And there was much more emphasis placed on it. In fact, you know, like the early humanists like Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo, these guys were furious, like ferociously individualistic. I mean, apparently that's why Michelangelo in that whole, that painting on the Sistine Chapel with God touching Adam, why it looks like a human brain. Apparently that's part of his whole fuck you attitude to the church, his individualism through that painting. Now, you might contest and say, well, you know, maybe that's too vague or so on and so forth. But I think if you study Michelangelo, you find out that this guy is pretty much a rebel, very independent. And I think that in any sense, like movements like this, movements that focused on the rights of the individual would, of course, have to be strongly individualistic, regardless of what that meant. Either it was right or wrong, it doesn't matter. You're just like, we need to put more focus on the individual. And I think that this is where we see the real birth of humanism. Because how else can you actually, like, how can you operate in a world in which the individual has no, like, isn't important, where they have no real consequence, where only the church is important? Like, this is not a humanistic value. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing I think that most people don't really know about early humanism is that they really, it was a return to the classic literatures, but they felt, because, you know, this is the medieval time, they felt that the classic thinkers were actually much more advanced than they were. They viewed studying the classics as moving forward. You know, kind of like, you ever play one of those Japanese RPGs and they always have the ancients or people who invented spaceships and shit like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, think the same way. And I mean, it makes sense because their moral philosophy was less advanced than people who had come up with them like 1,000 or two, you know, like over 1,000 years ago. I mean, it's got to be weird, right? Where you're just like reading stuff from the ancients. You're like, this is wiser than our shit. So you're obviously going to have this, I don't know, paradoxical moving forward by looking backwards kind of mentality. But the problem, I think, with the early humanists is that no one knew how to speak Greek. And the best philosophy at the time was Greek. Because the Romans, they didn't really respect intelligence. They didn't really respect philosophy all that much. So while they did recopy and translate things into Latin, it wasn't everything. So the early humanists were, and their works, like these were not really revolutionary ideas. It's only once in the 15th to 16th century where people actually started translating Greek philosophy that the shit really started hitting the fan. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't know if anyone has ever read Epicurus, but I can tell you right fucking now that if you're a Christian and you read that, it will blow your mind. And this man came up with the whole concept of an, you know, like how an omnipotent God is a fucking contradiction 300 years before the supposed birth of Christ. So, I mean, imagine you are of the thought that you, like, think of this. You are a religious person, right? You grew up in a religious environment. You believe in Jesus. But because you have this reverence and thirst for ancient knowledge, now you find texts that really shed some fucking harsh lights on your religion. What is going to be your response? What do you think the first response from the early humanists was, by the way, from this kind of conflict?
I figure they'd probably figure out what the answer to the old joke, how many humanists does it take to start a bonfire, question.
It's an interesting idea. Yeah, like they all sat down and said, what's this all mean? Well, no, actually, I would say that the first, like, at first, it didn't really interfere. Humanism was not in conflict with Christian doctrine, but what they did start to do was to create a separation between what they saw as divine power, which I think they still respected, and the secular natural world. So one of the early writers in this, by the way, was Dante Alighieri. You might know who he is if you've ever read The Divine Comedy, Dante's Inferno. These words sound familiar to you?
No.
You've what? Dante's Inferno.
I've heard of The Divine Comedy.
It's the same thing as Dante's Inferno.
I'm aware of Dante's Inferno mostly through the video game adaptions.
Oh God!
Look, it's a fucking long poem. I don't read anything that's a sonnet. I don't care if bitches like sonnets. I don't like sonnets.
I'm not telling you to read it, but I'm just saying, were you aware of it, or what
its
general sort of like? What is The Divine Comedy about?
I don't know.
Okay, well, it's about a guy traveling over to the different realms of, like, purgatory, hell, and heaven. And he has a guide throughout this and blah, 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 blah. The actual poem itself is not really that important. You don't really need to know anything that happens, except for probably the first sentence, which is, like, the most popular. It's like, halfway through the journey of my life, I found myself at a fork of the road, which is how the thing starts. But apart from that, you don't need to know shit. All you need to know from Dante Alighieri is the fact that Dante's Inferno was significant in that it was one of the first pieces of contemporary writings to not be written in Latin, but rather its native Italian, which at that time it was considered to be vulgar. Like, fucking Italian was just thought to be, like, you know, the common man's language, while Latin was considered to be the fucking educated man's language. So he really made a populist work, and he helped to elevate the Italian language and show, hey, you can have poetry and you can have drama through your own inherent language, which doesn't sound like a big deal now, but I think at the time it's pretty fucking revolutionary. And the second thing that he writes is probably his most heated pieces of writing. In fact, it was burned by the church later, and it was called On the Monarchy, well, as a rough translation. And essentially, his treatise was to say that there are two kinds of authority in this world. There's the Pope, who's the divine authority, and the purpose of the Pope is to ensure that you have as much happiness in the next life as possible. And then finally, there was, well, at least the way that Dante described it, the ruler in the real world, the secular ruler, the one that was not really dealing with religious issues. And, you know, he was arguing that the secular leaders should have more power and more authority within the real world. I think you can guess what kind of problems that would bring to an organization like the church, who really felt that they should have ultimate power.
Yeah, probably wasn't the most open response that he's ever heard.
Let's just say that there wasn't a lot of excitement at it. But yeah, generally speaking, Dante at the time was not really... I mean, his writings later became popular, but he suffered from that whole Van Gogh syndrome, where, you know, you're only really famous after you're fucking dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he suffered from that. But in a sense, like, his writing, his works really established the basis of literature that was not Latin-based, and really kind of introduced the writing artifices that would characterize the fucking Renaissance in later times. I think what's interesting about Dante, and you'll notice that any of the early Renaissance men were all poets, And at first I wasn't even sure why. Why are they all poets? Well, like, what's the importance of poetry? And I realized that poetry back then was probably the best way to be subversive, to say something without being explicit about it. And if you live in that world, this was necessary. You couldn't just come up and say, I fucking hate my government, fuck you. You didn't have that right. You would just probably be jailed and die.
But if you hide it in like a witty, some kind of witty poem that would take, you know, the Romans a little bit of time to figure out, then maybe you could say things like, you know, Caesar can suck my dick, but it has to be flowery. It has to be something like, and he can frolic upon the stem of my
He can
fertility. Sucketh
at the stem of my member. Yeah, so poetry, and in fact, art in the Renaissance is really probably the one of the ways that we see a lot of dissension from the typical authority structures. Like, apparently Renaissance paintings are very, very focused on the individual, on humanness. Even the Catholic Church, which was the biggest patron of art, asking, can you paint religious paintings and things like that? Apparently, in many of the paintings, there's so much a focus on the human element that the religious part just gets fucking buried, which is hilarious. I mean, you paid for a painting and it has no religious significance. It has a humanist significance. But this is what we see, like, as a progressive movement in Italy at the time. And a lot of it is subversive. You have no choice but to be subversive. You can't be open about it. All right. Lots of people have died being open about their fucking beliefs in that world. I mean, they're countless. I don't even want to fucking mention them because this is depressing. But, and you know how I mentioned, like, for instance, do you know how important Cicero was to the Renaissance mind? I'll give you the clearest fucking example. After the invention of the Gutenberg press in the 17th century, there was only one book that was printed more than the fucking Bible, and that was Cicero's writings.
Snap. So that's not too bad. That's not like a Van Gogh. Well, I guess he was probably dead already.
Cicero had been dead for like 1,000 years.
Okay. But still, that's some pretty good readership. I am impressed by that.
Well, I think that one of the things that inspired people is that Cicero spoke a lot about natural law. Okay, and this is something that you're going to hear a lot in the second part of our discussion, which is sort of another element of the Renaissance. And natural law is a kind of belief that good, virtuous feelings are inherent within all of us, okay? So that laws that we have are really more of a reflection of our internal moral compass. Some people attributed that moral compass to God, for instance, and, you know, we can obviously tell them that they're fucking wrong now. But, you know, many of the Renaissance thinkers didn't. They just assumed that natural law was a kind of consequence of the types of pressures that we have in nature, almost similar to evolution, in fact. And the idea of natural law can be seen actually in the U.S., in the Constitution of the United States. So when they say that every man, is born with laws and things like that, this is an example of natural law. And while we might not think that that's a big deal, you have to remember that there were competing thoughts about how laws were formed. Like Thomas Hobbes, for instance, he believed that laws were actually completely human constructs. He called it legal positivism. So he said, like, you know, if you have any rules for against murder or that kind of stuff, that's entirely driven by the state and not inherent to any human. And like I said, I mean, like, that's a complete contradiction to natural law. So let me ask you this question. You don't have to decide right now, but which one do you think sounds more appropriate? Are laws entirely man-made, or is there some element in us that seems to be law-driven?
Like, as in, do our laws come from our moral foundations?
Right. Do they come from something internal within us, or are they entirely the product of human beings trying to form societies and groups to avoid the horribleness of life?
It's a tough question, right? It's a philosophical question. You could make arguments for both.
Well, okay, here's the thing. I would actually say that Thomas Hobbes is wrong. While you could make arguments to say that, yes, laws are man-made, and we have tons of examples of laws that are man-made in order to be able to keep the structure of society whole, I still believe that inherent in those laws is some naturalistic element. Like, we see it in other species, reciprocity. We've seen in other species, generosity. I mean, all of the attributes of humanity can be seen in nature. And I think that this flies in the face of this whole idea that laws are entirely artificial. But it's not to say that laws are universal. Like, for instance, your own innate natural law might be pretty fucked up. You know, like, I'm sure Charles Manson has a kind of internal natural law that doesn't really quite make sense with our own. But I think that it would be difficult to deny the fact that man is a moral animal. What that morality takes, I'm not going to fucking speculate on how far it goes. But I do believe that there is an element of natural law that it is in us. I don't know how far that extends, though. And I definitely don't think it extends as far as many of these Renaissance philosophers are fucking talking about, right? Like, they didn't know anything about evolution. Although, you know, if you read Thomas Hobbes' stuff, it seems almost to kind of indicate this belief in evolution. Like, for instance, the survival of the strongest and fittest are somewhat mentioned in the Leviathan and shit like that. So, you know, there's those early little elements. But like I said before, I mean, Cicero was all about natural law. And this is why I said that he was like the fucking most influential philosophers of our time. Because the Declaration of Independence, because most major philosophers at the time would quote having Cicero in their fucking library. I mean, like, this was the dude. This was the dude who taught the world how to create a republic. And as much as you fucking hate some of the things the U.S. does, you cannot deny that them building the democratic republic that eventually became the United States of America had a profound influence in the rest of the world and how it saw democracy. And so much of that was influenced by Cicero, man. Like, he was a proponent of the republic. That's why he hated fucking Caesar and Mark Antony, these fucking tyrants who wanted to take away the power of the republic. And you know, like, every once in a while we fucking struggle with these forces, don't we? You know, the republic versus the charismatic fucking leader that's going to decide everything for you and take away the hard choices that you have to make.
Yeah, the ones that actually get shit done, as opposed to like the House and the Senate who just bicker and do nothing.
It is kind of like that whole subtle balance between the republic and a dictatorship. And you know, the funny thing about when the Rome decided that Caesar was going to be their leader, it was to try to come up with a way of countering that whole nothing's getting fucking done, right? But of course, it ruined their republic and turned them into a pretty much a dictatorship. So what would you prefer? Shit getting done quickly or having a lot more personal liberties? That's a fucking tough one because, you know, I'm sure we're all kind of anxious to get shit done. Like, oh, why can't this be done? Or why can't this? If only we had a benevolent tyrant. Yeah, that's a bad idea. And in fact, you know, that's what cost Cicero's life. Because he was against, you know, Octavius, and or who later become Augustus and all of their triumvirate and shit like that, he was killed. He was murdered because he did not fit into this new world.
Or like straight up stabbed or something?
Well, here's actually the story. So apparently Cicero was so loved by everyone that at the time they were looking for him to execute him, no one would tell him where he was. The only person that ratted him out was a recently freed slave that he had. And he was like, you know, traveling to try to escape to, I think, Macedonia at the time. And he got ambushed by these two soldiers. And once he realized that it was over, he stuck his head out and be like, all right, if you're going to do it right and make it quick. So, but to be fair, Cicero had long considered killing himself after he was deposed from the Roman Senate. He became very depressed and, suicidal. But he, you know, all in all, he was apparently a great orator, and he was a lawyer. You know this? He made his mark actually convicting a local dictator and getting, like, he managed to do the impossible. He managed to get the populace of people to find their own dictator guilty due to the overwhelmingness of his evidence and the power of his fucking speech, dude. That's impressive.
It's I like the Cicero guy, and it's interesting because as far as humanism went, I always thought that humanism was more something that kind of came around in the 1920s, 1930s, guys like Bertrand Russell, writing all their essays and going around having conversations about it. That was my understanding. So even when we just started the show, when you were like, "Yeah, that stuff goes way back," I never knew.
Well, you know, one of the early humanists was Leonardo da Vinci. He was also a vegetarian, by the way. So, I mean, we think about that time, those times, as people who were probably more brutal or savage, or, you know, a product of nature, red in tooth and claw. But I think what we have to understand is that, you know, like when Cicero was talking about the rights of the Republic, or the necessity of being virtuous, and this is eventually how the early humanist movement, some of the values that they attributed to themselves, was this whole pursuit of being virtuous. See, the whole thing about natural laws is that the one thing that it focuses on is not the action itself. So let's pretend I give you money, right? Which, in sort of like, as far as most people are concerned, might be a good act. But you have to, in natural law and in the philosophy of Cicero, you have to look at the consequences of the actions, like the overall consequence. So if I give you money, but I do this to impress someone else, I'm not doing anything moral, because the impetus of the reason why I did it is still immorally based. So the idea was that a person should try to achieve a certain degree of virtuousness in themselves, that the actions that they pursued were good for just simply the purpose of being good, that they had no ulterior motive except for the good. And I think that this is one of probably the greatest emerging philosophies at that time, because, you know, look at the way that religion teaches what is the good. The good is obedience. The good is doing what fucking God tells you to do. So the actions of what you do are inconsequential. As long as you obeyed God's word, what you did was justified and right. But when we look at sort of like the philosophy of Cicero, we realize that that's fucking garbage. It really is the consequences of your actions which are measured, rather than the actions themselves. And I think that is one of the ways in which humanism begins to grow and take that element of the experience of being human into it. Like saying, you can't separate those elements. You can't just say, well, my action was good and it doesn't matter the fucking consequences. And I think that just once you accept that one premise, you realize that it has far-reaching consequences. You know, what are the consequences of my actions? What are the externalities of what I do? I think even in today's world, we don't even really consider that anymore. We just look at sort of like the basic actions and we don't care about their consequences. You know, like think about modern corporations these days. They're allowed to operate however the fuck they want, so long as they obey their main mandate, which is to make people money. The negative externalities, the way that human beings are fucking influenced in that, is not really considered. And in a sense, we've moved backwards in that. You know, like, we could learn a thing or two from fucking rereading Cicero, could we not? Do we think ourselves so fucking morally superior that he has nothing to teach us?
Well, there's a lot of people who think they're morally superior and they haven't read anything but, you know, a smattering of the Bible. So what are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the people who pretend to be morally, you know, righteous, one of the things they don't realize is so much of that morality is a consequence, direct consequence, of the early humanist movement. And there's lots of ways that, you know, like the early humanists were responsible for, you know, incredible acts of peace and mercy that had not otherwise been the common practice. Like, I remember there was this one, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Niccolo de Medici. There was an attempt on his life by a couple of, you know, people within Florence and shit like that. You got to understand, Florence was pretty much like the epicenter of the Renaissance, and also probably the richest, most important city. Contested and fought by a variety of fucking families and shit like that. Like, it is, you could make like Dallas, but with the time in the Florence. In fact, I think if you watch the TV series The Borgias, it's entirely about that. The Borgias were an influential family, and one of the Borgias became Pope Alexander VI. Do you remember last show I told you that I was playing a lot of Assassin's Creed 2?
Yep.
The main bad guy in Assassin's Creed, in Assassin's Creed 2 is Pope Alexander VI. You fight him in the Vatican as the end boss. So if you are interested in history and you haven't played this series, I'm going to slap you in the fucking face. I'm like, you got to go play this now. Just because fighting a pope in the Vatican as an end boss. And by the way, when you're fighting him, the entire time the pope is telling you that he doesn't believe in, like, God. How awesome is that? Seriously, how has every non-believer not played this fucking game?
Well, how many times must this have been true? How many? We've heard all about the priest that loses his faith. It's a popular trope, but you got to imagine, especially these guys who are climbing the ranks inside the Vatican. They must have access to some stuff and some information, and just like from seeing the way that the system is rotten from the inside out, it must be hard to keep your faith.
Well, you know, it's actually funny. Machiavelli's book, The Prince, the one that I just mentioned, that's kind of like a symbol of individualism and a kind of like, you have to understand that when Machiavelli wrote The Prince, he wasn't defending the actions of the prince, by the way. It was just a sort of, I guess, a political treatise. But the funny thing is that the person that the prince is based on is the son of Pope Alexander VI, Caesar Borgias, who had an incestuous relationship with his sister. And I'm telling you, this family, the Borgias, very interesting period of time. And Caesar Borgias had apparently commissioned Leonardo da Vinci as one of his patrons, but he was a patron of of Leonardo da Vinci. So, I mean, I'm telling you, this is all some pretty tightly knit shit where everybody's like knows everybody and that kind of stuff. It's a tiny community of people, man. And they all sort of like lived around the same time. That's why I'm saying, like, this is in the period of history during the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th century, like, this is where all the shit happens, man. This is where people start really expressing themselves differently from what we had previously seen with the medieval ages. Like I said before, I mean, this is when the word Dark Ages comes from, when people realize that, oh my God, there was all this knowledge before. These guys were awesome. Like, let's read some, Cicero. Let's read the early Greek philosophers, Democritus and Hippocrates and those motherfuckers. Like, it must have just blew their minds. And the funny thing I think about the early humanist movement is it was not really in conflict with the church at the time. Like, the early humanists were religious people. They had just created a kind of separation, right? There was the secular world. And that was the world of governance, of laws and shit like that. And then there was the divine world, which is where you went when you died and all this other fucking shit happened. And I don't think it's until much later, during this whole period of the Renaissance, that it started to really conflict with the views and ideas of the church. Because once you start really getting into the Greek writers, the very same people that the Catholic Church pretty much banned the writings of, you realize that there was a reason why they did that. Because it kind of flew in the face of the teachings of the church. And it was that sort of like, you know, it was that impetus, like the need to read the philosophers of old, that really in a sense led to that erosion. And the modern humanist movements that we attribute to, you're not wrong when you say, like, when you think Bertrand Russell and those guys, like back in the 1930s or 1960s, the word was reappropriated. What we understand humanism has for the most part been grounded in religion. And this brings me to the point about the whole atheism plus and why some people want to avoid the label of humanism. Right? Because atheism plus is essentially humanism. It's this idea that there should be equality and egalitarity between individuals. And this is a humanistic principle. Like, even some of the early humanist writers were talking about the rights of women, you know, and this is at its core. But I think that the reason people reject this notion is because there are still people who are Christian humanists. There are atheists, the secular humanists. There are many different denominations of humanists. And I think that non-believers trying to find an identity are rejecting this label because it has associations with religious people. Now, here's the problem I have with this, first and foremost. I think that's a mistake. If you, I don't know if you, did you listen to my last interview I did with Leo Igui of the International Humanist Association?
No, I have it on my iPhone, but I haven't listened to it yet.
Well, there was a part where I asked Leo, in all honesty, I said, look, I've been reading reports of Save the Children International, and they say we have to work with religious organizations. And I had a big problem with that because I was telling him, I'm like, look, doesn't this legitimize their power? Doesn't this allow them to continue to sort of like do bad? And his answer was really simple and extremely fucking convincing. And he's like, we don't have the luxury of not working with these people. We could sit by and try to argue, or we can work with individuals who are interested in working with us. And I thought that was a really powerful argument. And it's made me, I don't know, it's made me very critical of the Atheism Plus movement, only in the fact that I think that what it does is create a division where a division is not necessary. I understand that people want to be proud of their atheism. In fact, like, how many fucking times have I told people, you need to come out as an atheist? I say it all the time. But I don't think that coming out as an atheist necessarily means that you suddenly can't work with other people who share so many of the common values that you share and who may disagree with ultimately your conclusion about reality. Like, humanists around the world are people we should still work with. And I think that the label still applies. I mean, like, if you are an atheist and a humanist, I don't think that those two things conflict. In fact, I think that those things are important. I think it's important to work with other humanists because the suffering and the pain brought on by all of these other, well, we'll say non-humanist ideologies, and sometimes they are religious, but sometimes they're not, is more important than any division that we have, I think. But maybe that's my new opinion. Like, I feel like, is this me? Is this Jacob talking? Like, I've always been very strongly opposed to that, but I don't know. Maybe Leo convinced me. Maybe he brainwashed me or something.
Well, maybe it's just a situation where you realize that you're going to get further along with that realistic attitude. Because, I mean, a part of humanism, a part of atheism is about rational thinking and taking evidence. And if somebody convinces you that you're going to get further along doing something differently, then it doesn't surprise me that you'd change your ideas.
Well, I think that's the most important thing about the fact that we as non-believers, we have the ability to fucking change our minds, right? Like, we're not beholden to any dogma. Like, I don't have to listen to some pope to tell me how to act or how to think. The truth is, I can look at all of the evidence. I can look at that myself and come to that conclusion. Like I said, I mean, it is a humanistic principle. It's a principle of individualism. And you know what? I strongly believe in individualism, perhaps even a little bit more than I believe in collectivism. Because I think that in any society in which you ignore the individual is probably a society where there is some harm to that individual. That's what you're ignoring. Like, I think it's a good basis. Like, as long as individuals are able to pursue their own happiness. And by the way, that's an idea from Cicero. This whole notion that government should be responsible for increasing the happiness of its citizens. Yeah, that's Cicero. And you can, like I said before, I mean, you can see this in the Declaration of Independence, right? This notion that happiness is important, but this is an individualistic notion. And I don't think that that's something that we should disregard. And in fact, the one thing I think is harmful about Atheism Plus, because I know that there's a ton of people who say this is divisive and shit like that. I'm not even going to pretend that it is, because, you know, if you want to associate yourself with that, fine. It's not like you're going to fucking cause me any problems or just tell me that I'm a piece of shit. You can have yours and I can have mine. That's fine. The only thing I find is a big problem, though, is it seems to ignore everything that humanism created before it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just honestly feel like we shouldn't ignore the history of this, because some fucking great men have been humanists. And I just don't think that we need to reinvent the wheel. And in fact, perhaps even reinventing the wheel makes us less capable of working with other groups who would describe themselves in the same way. Because really, my atheism just, it differentiates itself from, a Christian humanist, as in, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any of this tertiary nonsense that this fellow humanist has believed in. But I'm not going to fucking turn around and tell him that his humanism is wrong. Maybe there's some elements of it that I fucking disagree with, but at its core, those elements haven't changed. And I think that's actually what's admirable about humanism, is it has not changed its focus. in all of this time. And in fact, I think that focus has evolved. And we should come back and we should look again at humanism. Like, have we fucking forgotten about it? I don't think people realize that if we worked more with that label, even with other people that are religious and humanists as well, we would get more fucking done. And, you know, here's my closing fucking argument to anybody who's an atheist plus. What have you really done? You know, like I said, I was interviewing Leo Igwe. If you want to know a fucking human being that's out there doing the hard work, he's one of those motherfuckers. He's not just sitting on his ass blogging all day, okay? He's involved in trying to fucking save lives. And as far as he's concerned, creating these types of divisions is not going to help the situation in Africa. And you know what? I agree with him now. And I think it's something we should all fucking consider when we think about this new emerging movement.
Well, it's also kind of important to note that, you know, we are already aware there are many, many, many surveys that go out and say that atheism's got a bad rap. Maybe it's time that we, like the Catholic Church, kind of take a look at, you know, that it's one of the terminologies that we have and look for something a bit softer. I mean, they took child rape and they changed it to the much softer child abuse.
And now they're geniuses when it comes to that.
Instead of taking atheism and going, well, now let's make atheism plus. It sounds like some kind of health supplement that's really got everything you need in it.
All the important vitamins.
But humanism has always been one that I like. Humanism is kind of like people who aren't willing to call themselves atheists call themselves agnostics. I think it's a lot easier to get people, especially those who are on the fence and especially those who are, you know, generally atheists but don't want to label themselves as such, they're probably more comfortable investigating a bit of humanist literature, getting into the ideas of humanism.
Well, it's true. I mean, you said it yourself, right? It's a lot. There's not a lot of aggressiveness when it comes to humanism. And I think that I've read so many comments about people's attitudes towards atheism plus, which are divided, right? I haven't even found anyone who's actually pretty neutral about this whole notion of atheism plus. But what it reminds me of is that in any particular philosophy or ideology, what happens is that people are often forced to extremes, opposite views. Look in the U.S., Democratic versus Republican. Is anyone really willing to meet in the middle? I mean, you've read the stuff. It's getting worse and worse, right? The rhetoric on both sides. Like, I don't even think anybody can just kind of get along anymore. And it's part of human nature. Like, when you believe in one thing, you will always find evidence that tends to agree with you, and you will be reluctant to listen to anything that disagrees. This is what I think the challenge of humanism is, because there are people within it that don't believe in the same things that you do, that may in fact challenge what it is that you believe. But at least if you are a humanist, you are never forced to one extreme. Because, in a sense, humanism is much more inclusive. And this is why I think that we should really drop this whole atheism plus. I think it is a reflection of the frustration of female bloggers who have experienced a lot of sexual harassment online through trolls, and then who make the assumption that internet trolling has a broader reality. And I think that those are mistaken assumptions. Trolling is bad. We should all sort of speak out against the particulars of trolling, but always understand that the internet can be a heinous place, and it doesn't necessarily reflect the attitudes and thoughts of people. It actually disproportionately represents them in a negative way. So, you know, if that movement is itself kind of crafted or born from this conception, I really don't think that it's that positive. I actually think that it's negative. I think it's a reaction rather than a positive movement. And I think that we should think about that.
It kind of reminds me of you know, the purity tests that Republicans were basically forced to do recently with Grover Norquist and his tax pledge and various other examples, where basically constituents will go to a politician and say, if you don't vote with us on this specific kind of topic, then your name is mud. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, you're not our Republican, we'll kind of drum you out. And atheism plus seems like and you know what? I understand completely the reasoning. For the 10 seconds that I was involved in the Montreal atheism scene, there was a woman that was there who didn't believe in God, but she also believed very strongly in homeopathic medicine. And it was a big problem, mainly because she was a crackpot, and she just didn't know how to shut her mouth. But it was a distraction, and it was a problem, and it was a debate that didn't need to be happening. So I can understand all of a sudden there must be issues like that all the time where, oh, yeah, let's all get together as atheists. Oh, but this person believes in something completely stupid. So now we have to deal with that. So Atheism Plus is just one of those things that says, well, look, here's, hurting atheists is like hurting cats. We all have different beliefs. And this is just kind of a way to put more structure to what has always been a very wide category of people. So all of a sudden, if you want to be an Atheist Plus, it means that, you know, that automatically just kind of explains your position on a whole number of different topics.
Right. And like I said before, I mean, I'm not going to start, you know, I'm not going to accuse anyone of Atheism Plus to be divisive or whatever. I do agree with you that there seems to be this implication of a purity test, like, hey, are you a misogynist? If you are, you're not included. And I'm like, well, how do you define that? You know, like, how is that defined? Of course, there could be people who are on such extremes that it would be easy to identify them. But, you know, how do you deal with individuals that claim themselves to not be misogynistic, but who are accused of it? And this, I feel, is still kind of like that part of the issue. And this is where I think we're going to get in a lot of trouble. You can already see this in a number of blogs where other non-believers have been, you know, accusing other non-believers of being bad bloggers. And it's gotten really personal. I've stayed out of it mostly because I just feel like it's pretty petty and shit. And I've been really trying to concentrate on bringing you guys real news, you know, like the suffering of fucking kids in Africa. You know, people in Pakistan being accused of blasphemy and potentially getting murdered that way. I think these are important issues. And I think that we're all getting distracted by this sort of like purity test and inability to really differentiate between opposing views and views that are just simply wrong. And I think that a lot of people, they view that if someone doesn't agree with them, they must be inherently wrong and they don't want to associate with them and so on and so forth. And I think that that's not really an interesting way to have a conversation. We should have conversations with people who disagree with us. It is our job to fucking convince them. And I think that we should always be having rational discourses. Like I said, I didn't participate in this because I thought it got really personal. And I always wanted you guys to just see that the good atheist sort of rises above that shit to some degree. Like, I want to deal with the bigger issues. But at the same time, I can't ignore the issues that we ourselves are facing. And I wanted to mention it in the sense of saying, like, hey, guys, if there was any philosophy that, you know, we should attribute ourselves to, I got to tell you, if I had to make a choice, it would be humanism, not Atheism Plus. Because I don't agree with all the things that the people who espouse that philosophy are talking about. And I believe that humanism has a deeper history of philosophy and thought that we should not ignore just because the people who thought of them were religious. That's all. I think it's a pretty fucking plain way to just say, just because a person, you know, a thinker was religious doesn't mean any of the things they thought was wrong. And doesn't mean that it doesn't apply to us, you know, today. It's just that they believed in something ridiculous. It probably didn't seem ridiculous at the time, by the way. Probably seemed like the normal thing to believe.
Probably seemed like the good thing to believe if you didn't want to get burned at the stake.
Well, there is that, too. You know, there's the I don't want to fucking die at the stake thing, which definitely fucking helped. But, you know, reading these guys, like, these are intellectuals, right? These are people who believed in their own integrity. And, despite them not having a very consistent worldview, they still believe that their ideas had integrity, and I think that we should just examine the integrity of those very beliefs rather than looking at the beliefs as a whole. And we should appreciate the fact that I think that if you really look at the history of humanism, it's the history of of the individual interest in the human experience and what that means. Are there inherent laws that are within us? What is the good life? These are questions that humanists have been asking for a very long time, and I think that we should just not ignore that conversation. Just because we want to identify ourselves so strongly as non-believers. And while I still think that's important to identify yourself as an atheist, I think that it's also equally important to not ignore titles and names that still serve a purpose in today's fucking pragmatic world. And that's all I have to say about that. Okay, that wraps it up for the show. Next week, we're going to have a whole bunch of other interviews. I'm going to have Jerry DeWitt, who's going to be on. I have Sylvia Brooks, who's working on that I just did an interview for, that's going to be coming up. She's doing a project called Hug an Atheist. And I'm also been invited to Skepticon this year, although I don't know if we can actually manage that. But I will be interviewing many of the people from Skepticon itself. So it's going to be like a whole month of like a shitload of interviews and podcasts. Like, Good Atheist is on track, people. On track. We're releasing fucking podcasts like on schedule, so that means Mondays and Wednesdays, or if you're really fucking ambitious, Sunday at midnight and Tuesday at midnight. That's when you can get your show, you big addicts. That's when they're released, and they're going to be consistent like that for as long as I can. That's my promise to you, people.
For as long as you can. That's a good promise. I promise you that they will always happen to the best of my ability.
Okay, but let me give you a scenario, right? I'm working hard to make sure this happens, but what if I get sick, right? I'm trying to make enough shows that I'm caught up, but, it's a Jacob promise.
Yeah, realistically, things happen.
Things fucking happen. And, it was really funny, because even when I mentioned saying, like, I want to do these many shows, I had a whole bunch of fans being like, don't hurt yourself. If you can't do a show, that's okay. That's okay. And I'm like, what the fuck? Don't say that shit. You're going to encourage my laziness. My goal is to fucking entertain you guys and to keep consistent, to be part of your habit daily or whatever. And that's my fucking new mandate up until the book's done. Which is like, oh, by the way, anybody who bought the book and who's been messaging me being like, where's my book? You bought a pre-order. Don't make me message you and saying you got to wait. Because it just makes me feel foolish. You bought a pre-order. I'll also be releasing next week, because there's a few more. Remember how I offered like for 250 people could have their face in the book? We managed to sell about 18 of them, but I still need to sell a few more. So I'm actually going to be introducing a payment plan. So if anyone's interested in having their face in the book but can only afford about $25 a month, send me an email, jake@thegoodatheist.net, and I will put you on that payment plan, and you will have your fucking face in the book. Because we're still trying to sell those, and I'd like to include a couple more people who want to be immortalized. So, payment structure, yay! That's being introduced. So if anybody's interested in that, please let me know. And I think that pretty much wraps up the show. So with that, I'd like to thank Ryan for joining me. Thank you for being part of pretty much like a super history podcast that I'm sure... for you was a little bit boring.
No, it was actually very enlightening. I love that history shit.
People have been like, hey, Jacob, you should do a history podcast and that kind of stuff. If Good Atheist ever flops, I guess I'll do that. Do a history podcast. Because I'm sure. Yeah, sounds good. All right, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.